Stefan.
Yes, it is.
Just bear with us for a minute. We're working through some technical issues, trying to get the big screen to work again.
Excuse me, this call is now being recorded. If you object, you may disconnect at this time.
Thank you, operator. As the call is, the recording has started. I'll just explain that we're waiting for Michele to set up while we work through a technical issue. We'll now hear from three updates from three of our working groups. The first one will be the IRTP-B inter-registrar transfer policy, Part B working group. That update will be given by Michele Nailon, and then we'll have the PDNR update from Alan Greenberg, and we'll finish with the internationalized registration data working group. That will be Edmund giving that update. So, Michele, I believe you're ready. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everybody. Sorry for the delay with this. Technical issues, of course. This is just a brief update on the IRTP Part B working group. IRTP refers to the inter-registrar transfer policy, and it's Part B of a series. So just the background, inter-registrar transfer policy, straightforward process for registrants to transfer domain names between registrars. It's currently under review to ensure improvements and clarification. And that's the correct slide. So the questions we've been asked to try and answer would be, first, should there be a process or special provisions for urgent return of hijacked registration, inappropriate transfers, or change of registrant? We've also been asked to look at registrar lock statuses, looking at the standards, the best practices, and also to clarify the denial reason number 7 in the current policy. The working group at PDP was initiated in June 2009. We published our initial report back in the end of May of this year, and we had a public comments after the meeting in Brussels. We received 17 comments from the community, and we have pretty much reviewed all of those comments to date and we are currently debating and deliberating, finalising our recommendations. The next steps, meeting in Cartagena this week to review results of a survey that we've conducted within the working group, and trying to work out basically which areas we need to work on further, which areas we need to discuss further. I mean, we've had a lot of lengthy discussions to date. For example, the one area which has brought up some interesting feedback has been a proposal that we put forward for an expedited transfer reverse policy. We felt that there weren't enough acronyms within the ICANN world, so we thought we'd add a few of our own. So we gave you the wonderful ETRP. And while this started off as one thing, it's kind of mutated into something else, and now we're trying to work out if we can bring it back to some level of sanity. And then, of course, if we can finalise our recommendations, then we'll publish those for public comment. And we're hoping and praying, at least I'm praying, to be able to get this put to bed by San Francisco. And if you want to read up any further on it, our initial report is available there at the link up above. And if anybody has any questions, please feel free.
Are there any questions for Michele on that report? Yeah, Mike.
Michele, I think it would be probably beneficial if you would just talk for another 4 or 5 minutes or 3 minutes, whatever, about the ERTP, with sort of some detail about that for the council that might not be familiar with it.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, okay, basically one of the key questions that we've been asked to look at is in relation to hijacks of domains. I mean, it's in the simplest terms, you have a domain with a registrar, and you wake up one morning and you discover that that domain is no longer with that registrar and possibly is no longer displaying the content that you expect it to display. In the kind of more obvious cases would be, let's say, if an Amazon.com type website were suddenly to go offline because somebody had somehow managed to capture that domain name and was doing whatever with it. Under the current policies, there is an option for to escalate things back up to the registries. However, that can take quite a bit of time. And the concern that people have is that if, say, in the case of the Amazon scenario, while you know, sorting out your divorce or something, it might be okay that it might take 60 days, but if you're looking at a multi-million dollar website, every hour that it's offline is going to cost that company thousands and thousands of dollars. So how do you get it to get it back to a state that is, you know, what it was like previously? What seems to happen in the current scenario is that registrars sort out the problem between themselves with a bit of assistance from the registries. So, for example, if a registrar that you might work with might be talking to another registrar, and they'd resolve it that way amicably and fairly as quickly as they possibly could. The problem, of course, is that if you are an intelligent hijacker, you're going to choose to move the domain to a registrar that either isn't that responsive or might be hard to track down, might have a shortage of staff, any number of different scenarios. So the group came up with the concept of this rapid return type process. The full details of what was put together and proposed is in the initial report. But the basic idea being that if you were the original holder registrant of the domain name that was purportedly hijacked, you would have an option to go back to the registrar you were dealing with originally and say, hey, why the hell isn't my domain with you anymore? Why is it pointing somewhere else? Why is somebody else's details in the whois, etc., etc., etc.? And that the domain would be reversed back to that original state very, very quickly. Unfortunately, of course, the world is not a simple place, so there are a lot of trying to think of the diplomatic way of putting this, there are a lot of complications with the entire scenario. Kind of things that we're struggling with are things like, say, for example, if I have a domain name that I would consider to be, you know, a nice domain, and you came along and you said, "Hey, Michele, would you sell me that domain? I'll give you $1,000, to say hypothetically. Let's say $10,000, make it a bit more interesting." And I go, "Oh, cool, that's really nice, excellent. I can, you know, pay for a nice holiday this Christmas." So I give you the domain for $10,000, and then a couple of days later, somebody else comes along and offers me $50. And I'm like, "Oh God, what have I done? You know, I've sold them this domain. Damn, what can I do? Oh, I know what I can do. I can use this this little tool here that ICANN has created, and I can abuse the living bejesus out of it and get that domain back and then sell it on to somebody else." This kind of scenario is one of the problems we're facing. But it still doesn't solve the actual problem of the high-value domain name being hijacked. And then, of course, you've got other complications, thick registries versus thin registries. You know, was the registrant listed in Whois at the time of the transfer the legitimate domain holder, or was that already the hijacker? There's a whole range of other things with this, and it's something that we've been deliberating at length and in detail and quite excitedly, I suppose, or there's been a lot of passion brought into it from various different parties. But ultimately, the thing is that we have to try and we recognise that there is an issue, but whether we can find a clean and sane way to deal with it or not is the problem.
So, Kamak, any other questions for Michele before we move on? Looks like your explanations were perfectly clear. Thanks very much, Michele, for doing that. Thank you.
Thank you.
So next is Alan, please.
Thank you. Wait for we get the presentation up. No, you go ahead. Thank you. First thing you see about our group is we weren't smart enough to come up with an acronym with a really nice pronounceable, rather with a name which has a really nice pronounceable acronym. PEDNR somehow sounds illegal or immoral or something, I don't know. All right, for those who are new to the game, the PDP is looking at to what extent registrants have the opportunity and knowledge to reclaim domain names if they let them expire. The PDP group was the working group was formed July of last year. We're examining five specific questions associated with this that were defined by council. And in an unusual move, council also put into the charter what the outcomes would be, and that is either consensus policy or best practices. Next. An interim report was published, I believe, for the Brussels meeting, if I remember correctly. It included one of our first part of the task was to survey the largest registrars, which I think consisted of about 9 or 10 of ICANN's largest registrars, to try to understand what their existing practices were. And that was published in the report. One of the more interesting results of that was to find that the existing practices were not particularly bad, but typically did not correspond to what the contract said at all. And we summarized working group deliberations. We looked at some compliance information. We had done two different surveys of the working group and identified what positions were taken by working group members, And although it was called an initial report, there were no recommendations included. We weren't at that stage, but we did want an opportunity to talk to the public. Next. As is common with any report, we did a public comment field, and we got a number of public comment forum, and we got a number of comments that we have addressed and will be addressing in future recommendations. We also did something a little bit unusual. We did a survey. And the survey was aimed not at people in the working group, although one or two did answer, but at the user public or the general public, at least those that read ICANN websites. We got over 400 responses, and the results were interesting, I think, to say the least. And we are now looking at where we're going from now in terms of the I was on the wrong slide on my own screen. We've reviewed both the formal comments and the user survey. If we can go on to the next one, please. This is an example of the survey that was done within the work group. And you'll notice that the group is split. Top half are essentially users of various forms. Bottom half are registrars and are one registry participant. And the shaded blue ones identify essentially the user perspective, which predominates. The first column was one on asking, should registrars take some action to try to make sure that registrants know that if they let domains expire, if they don't have good contact information, domains will expire or may expire. And you can see users generally said it should be a consensus policy requiring registrars to take some action. Registrars said no, status quo or best practice. The one item that we did have almost complete unanimity on was a change to who is. Right now, because of the auto-renew grace period where the registry for .org, .com, .net, and a number of other registries will automatically extend the registration for a year from the point of view of them and the registrar. And Whois is updated immediately. So if your domain name has expired, you go into Whois, it will have an expiration date a year from now. You say, phew, I don't remember paying, but I guess I did, and walk away. But at this point, you still don't have the domain name. So that users certainly felt that it should be changed, and registrars are awful annoyed at customers complaining, saying, hey, it says I've renewed it. Why did I really not? We'll come back to that one in a minute. Next screen. Another example of the complete split in the working group between the two classes, and I'm highlighting this split for a reason. I'll go onto it in a minute. And this is what should happen, for instance, with the website. Should it keep on working for the whole expiration period or stop working? And there was a feeling among users that it should stop working, and policy should say that, not necessarily believed by the registrars. Next screen. The user survey had said there was a large number of answers, and it gave us a nice distribution of answers. This particular graph says how many warnings should there be prior to expiration. Now, the current RIA, in a sort of backwards way, implies that there should be two notices. It doesn't really say that, but it sort of implies it. As you can see, the typical user answer said three. Some were more than three. Some said two. A few said one. There were always a small number of people, of course, who didn't answer the question. Next slide. This was a question on for what period of time after expiration should a user be able to renew the domain name. And one of the critical timings that you should know is that the auto-renew grace period has a maximum of 45 days. Under the EDDP consensus policy passed several years ago, it's limited to that. And typically registrars give about 30 days. It varies. And the answer is, I think, quite according to what we expected, centered around 30 days. Some people said less, some people said more. Next screen. All right, where we are right now. We have compiled a set of recommendations, and they came from both registrars and from the user community. And we are working our way through the list. The remarkable thing, and I say remarkable, if you look at the previous charts I had where there was a virtual complete split between registrars and users, I won't say we have full consensus, but we're coming to agreement on almost all of the issues. There are still a few ones which are thorny, and it's not clear how we're going to resolve them. We may end up coming up with a final report with a minority and majority, a majority and a minority report in it on a recommendation and report in a number of particular issues. But most of them we seem to be coming to closure on, and I think that's a remarkable shift over the last couple of months, and I'm very optimistic, whereas before I don't think I was nearly this optimistic. The kinds of things we're looking at in terms of recommendations, and we're talking about recommendations for consensus policy, is a proposal to guarantee that registrants have a certain amount of time in which to recover a domain name. The times we're talking about range from 5 days up to 30 or so, and where we end up in the middle, or if we end up with two different versions, remains to be seen. Still, that's certainly a thorny one. We are looking at requirements on how many notices be sent and when they are sent. It's quite clear that a notice sent for a one-year registration that's sent 2 weeks after you buy the domain is probably not a practical way of reminding the registrant. On the other hand, sending it the day before expiration probably isn't practical either. So we're looking at a number of recommendations. How domains behave post-expiration, the general wisdom is that if you ignored all the messages, or when I say ignored, in many cases you may not have gotten them. They went into spam filters, they went to an email address you no longer use, or you just ignored them. The way to get someone's attention is ultimately have the domain stop working. This is a difficult one because if a domain is being used for a business, you don't really want to put the business stop the business's actions. On the other hand, there is some strong evidence that people will not renew until you hit them over the head. And having something go black or not work function well is hitting them over the head. It gets more interesting because a large number of domains are used only for email. So redirecting a website doesn't help wake them up in that case. The only thing that you can wake them up with is stop sending them email and hope they notice. Not everyone does, apparently, based on the articles you see in newspapers occasionally. But again, it's contentious because some people don't want to stop things from functioning, but there is evidence that it may be the only way. When the RGP was invented almost a decade ago, there was assumption among some of the people involved at that point that it would become a consensus policy. However, council never did it. It never, I guess, rose to a level of priority, and we are now considering seriously that the RGP be made a consensus policy for all registrars and for most registries. There appear to be some registries for which it just does not fit, and we're looking at how one words exceptions around that. The real concern, however, is if you look at what happened, I think when the RGP was invented, there was only .org, .com, and .net. No? You were around it? Okay, so it was a few years later. Info and Biz also support it. None of the sponsored GTLDs support it, and none of the other new ones, unsponsored ones, support it either. The general belief is if it's not in the contract as a requirement, probably none of the new GTLDs will support it either. And the only way to make sure that's fixed is either put it in the make it a consensus policy, or of course ICANN could willingly put it in the agreement for new GTLDs, but the draft agreements have not included it. So it looks like consensus policy is probably a way to force the issue. We are talking about an exception process for registrars for some of the requirements. It would appear that business practices around the world are sufficiently different that some of the policies that we think make sense completely in the Western market, for instance, may not work in other places. An example is the case of making the web and email stop working shortly after expiration. There are registrars around who say, no, we want to keep it going, and we will take all means to try to make sure our customers know about it. We'll make phone calls, we'll go knock on their door, and we'll wake them up one way or another. And we feel that we need to accommodate different business practices and that there somehow must be a process by which a registrar can say, we don't want to do what is in the detailed policy, but we want to follow the intent. And we're still discussing how we could do that. It's an ugly issue that we'd prefer not to get into, but we don't see any way of avoiding it. And I think that is about all. There's some references and open for any questions.
Thanks, Alan. Can I ask just about the next steps, where you feel, on what timeline you feel the group will reach the objectives and the next steps that you've just outlined?
Okay. If this meeting was being held about 6 weeks ago, I would have given a far more negative report than I am today. We were hoping the work group would have an opportunity to meet. The only time we were assigned was Thursday morning, where we had some members of the work group had as many as four conflicts, some only had one, but it was clear the working group could not meet. We tried finding another alternative, including 7 a.m. breakfast and things like that, and we did not succeed. So we are not formally meeting. Some of us are talking in the halls and things like that. So I had hoped to come out of this meeting almost a signed agreement, at least among the people in the work group. That won't happen. But I'm optimistic within some number of weeks into the new year, we will be able to come to closure on all or almost all of the issues and be able to start drafting a final report. So I'm optimistic. But Marika knows better, so let her speak.
Just to add, maybe, because as the initial report didn't have any recommendations or draft recommendations in it, the idea would be as well that there was probably a draft final report or whatever we called it would be put out for public comment before there is the final report to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to comment on the recommendations.
My apologies. Marika keeps on reminding me to say that, and I sort of assume it's a given that when we make recommendations, we have to go out for comment. But yes, we do have to go out for comment.
Thanks. Any questions for Alan? Okay. Alan, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And we'll now move on to Edmund for the Internationalized Registration Data Working Group.
Thank you, Stefan.
And we'll just need 1 second for Julie to...
As that's coming up, I guess I'll start by saying that a lot of the work, I just take this opportunity to thank Julie and Steve for the tremendous staff support on this to make, you know, to guide us, to help us through the process. Okay, so shall I start? No. We have more time than we're... Okay, so... Anyway, it shouldn't take too long, I hope, but... Okay, let's get started then. This is the Internationalized Registration Data Working Group, the otherwise known as IRD. It's a joint, actually it's a joint working group from the GNSO and the ESSAC, and it's looking into the internationalized registration data. We often talk about it as sort of who is data, but I'll jump into that in a bit. So just as IDNs are being deployed, and we're talking about IDN TLDs now as well, so that's this is the sort of work that the working group is tasked to do. So we'll talk about what we were discussing, so just an update, and then we did have a set of a report out with some preliminary recommendations. I'll go through that, and I think that's the more important part of it. We need some more input from the community now. We did put out some preliminary recommendations. So next slide. Before we started, we quickly realized that when we talk about who is, this word who is, there are very different, you know, there are a few different things that we're really talking about. And we sort of identified three so that we have a common terminology as we go through the discussion, so we don't confuse ourselves too much. The first one is what we call who is protocol, is the protocol itself and what's in the RFCs. And then the second one is the service, whether it's you're using a text-based a client or you're using a web-based client, the actual directory service that that you get the Whois data from. And then the third part, when sometimes we call Whois, is the data itself. So the protocol, the service, and the data, three different things that we sometimes just lump into calling Whois. And then we also, there's a particular terminology that we use, what we call must be present script. I'll come back to this, but it essentially means the ASCII representation of certain things. And that's just to in terms of the terminology that we use. Thanks. So when we started, we know that there's the IDN guidelines from ICANN and, of course, the IDN standards stuff. But for the Whois side of things, the service, both the data and the Whois and the service, the Whois service itself, there are no standards at this point. Next slide. And so really the objectives of the IRD working group was to identify what we need to do to internationalize the domain registration data, and also how to come up with a set of requirements for the Whois protocol to be internationalized. I think we, from the ICANN point of view, ICANN community point of view, we were probably not may not be specifying exactly the Whois protocol, but at least the requirements for what needs to be internationalized in the Whois protocol. So we jumped into the discussion that we had is, you know, starting with whether the existing U.S. Whois protocol is capable of supporting international registration data, how the querying and the display of internationalized registration data along with variants, because I think by now you've heard of IDN variants, especially for Chinese and some of the languages as well, what that needs to be done, what needs to be done in the Whois side of things. And then, of course, the what capabilities are needed in the directory service side, how to accommodate users, because users, as we go into an IDN world, there are users in this world where English or ASCII-based system really isn't the way they communicate and isn't the way they write their address or contact information. So how do we accommodate for that? So what we have done is that we came up with a few models for dealing with internationalized registration contact data at a policy level, and also some preliminary recommendations for consideration. Next slide. So we, you know, quite quickly realized that the Whois protocol itself, as it is right now, is really there really isn't a mechanism to, at least not a standardized mechanism to support internationalized data. So, you know, there's no particular mechanism to indicate the character set, and, you know, there's basically Whois is a fairly which is like freestyle type of protocol. Next. And so one of the things that the group quickly started tackling was the issue of variants, and we looked into IDN variants. This is one of the things that is sort of specific to IDNs, which is different from regular ASCII registrations. So, however, beyond the WHOIS implications, what how variants are defined, how variants are should be handled in terms of policy, that we've decided, you know, that's sort of outside of the scope of the IRD working group. However, what is in scope is that if a name is in the zone, in the DNS, then it should be reflected in WHOIS services, and that's sort of the distinction we're making. So what we've identified is that there are two types of variants. There are variants which are in the zone along with the primary IDN, and there are variants who are just reserved. And basically our current recommendation would be that what is called activated variants, which are the variants that are in the zone, in the DNS, along with this primary IDN, those variants should also have information through. You should be able to get the WHOIS information through the WHOIS service. So, and in terms of reserved variants, that would be somewhat of a matter of a local policy. Just to illustrate that a little bit more, what we really mean is that reserved variants, we sort of treat them sort of like reserved names. We do have reserved names, so to speak, in the TLD, but you know, if you go to the IANA WHOIS right now, you won't see them. But if there are reserved names in certain registries, and if you go to the WHOIS and say .asia, then you would see some response. So in terms of reserved variants, that's sort of the decision. That's sort of the recommendation so far. And to illustrate that, next slide. Wasn't there a slide to illustrate the WHOIS? Did I miss? Never mind. Along with the variant issue, what we're saying is that the WHOIS clients should be able to sub-query, and the WHOIS clients should be able to display the information in what is called the U label as well as the A label. U label is sort of in the native form of the IDN, and A label is the ASCII form of the IDN. So both should be supported by WHOIS clients, and then clients and servers. And for the variants, they should be on that particular point, and also that the U label, so the native form as well as the ASCII form, should be returned together, so that you know whoever's querying it can see both forms. And I think the next one is the example. There you go. So this is a sort of example of what we're recommending. So you see that when you query for a particular IDN name, you could query it in either the U label form, which is the native language form, or the ACE label form, the ASCII label form. And then when you get the response, both the domain in U label and the domain in the ACE label would be returned. So you can see both. And also, you would see the variant that are activated. So you would also see in the WHOIS response displayed the variant that is also in the DNS zone along with the primary domain. So this is an example of what we mean. So next. And then there were a number of items in the WHOIS data that we find we sort of cruise through some of the things that could be internationalized. We talked about the domain name side, which is which we said both the U label and the A label should be there. And somewhat similarly, the name servers, because you would have in the Whois response the name server names. And what the recommendation right now is to have that the A label must be there, and you should be able to present the U label optionally. We also identified, in terms of the sponsoring registrar, we feel that the it should at least have an ASCII representation. So, you know, if people want to figure out which registrar, that's what it is right now. So we sort of recommend that to remain. And telephone would follow the international standards, basically. And then the email... email is also going through an internationalization, and we're referring to the RFC for the email address internationalization. So basically following that standard for the collection of email if they're in an internationalized format. And then for the registration status, that should the EPP code should continue to be published exactly, you know, what the EPP code is and what the actual status, description of the status that might be up to the registry and registrar. In terms of dates, we haven't quite come to discussion about the dates, but how the dates should be formatted. But I think that shouldn't be a big issue at this point. So. Next slide. What we the sort of the meat of the discussion was in terms of the four. We came up with four models to represent registrant contact data, and these are four approaches that we wanted to get more input from the community on what the policy should be. Model one is essentially somewhat like I would say, you know, sort of like a status quo. That we would require registrant to provide contact data in a must-be-present script, like in ASCII, and that being the requirement. And then optionally, they can provide their contact information, that's the address information, in their own local script. That's model one. Model two is that the registrant would provide it in their own local script only. And so the Whois will not contain contact information in ASCII or English form, but the registrar contact, there will be a registrar point of contact, and that registrar point of contact needs to be able to deal with transliteration or translation. And so model three is that registrants... Model three would be for registrants to provide their information in their own language, in their local language, but the registrars are being tasked to create a transliteration of that data and present it in the Whois. Model four is similar to model three, except except that it's instead of providing the registrar providing just a transliteration, would be providing a translated version. I'll come to an example so to be better illustrate it. So next slide. So model one, as you see, there's a Russian example and a Chinese example. What it is that the registrant itself must provide their information in a must be present format, essentially in ASCII. So the registrant is tasked to provide the information in ASCII. That's model number one. That's sort of like status quo. Not quite, but sort of like status quo. Model two is that the registrant data would only be in their local language. So as you see in this example here, the Russian example or the Chinese example, then the address and the contact name, they only exist in their own local language. However, there's at the top you can see a registrar point of contact, and that there needs to be a registrar point of contact where people who want to contact the registrant will go through. that's Model 2. Model 3, here you see that Model 3 is that the registrant provides the information in their own local language, but the registrar then needs to transliterate the information into a must-be-present script, basically transliterate it into ASCII. And this is Model 3. And I wanted to point out Model 4. Model 4 is similar, except that you can see that in the, let's say, for the Chinese example, you can see Shenzhen, Guangdong province, and apartment, whatever, Ludan village. And that's a translation. So the registrar is tasked to translate what they received into English, essentially. So if we go back to Model 3, you can see that the difference is that right now you see Ludan Kun 13 Dong, whatever, and then Shenzhen Guangdong Sheng, which means Shenzhen province. And the address Zhongguo is People's Republic of China. So this is the difference between Model 3 and Model 4. In Model 3, it's the transliteration provided by the registrar, which may or may not be able to actually be used, and Model 4 is to require a translation. So, And then just to reiterate some of the preliminary recommendations that we have come out with, in terms of the Whois protocol clients and the client and the server, as I mentioned, what we're recommending is that the both the U label and the A label be able to be submitted and also displayed together in the display result. And then also in terms of the variants, that should also be presented as well if the variant is in the zone and is activated. And in terms of the data itself, again, it's sort of similar for the data. The A label and the U label must be included, both of which, both in the query and also for the name server names as well. If the name server names are in IDN format, then both the A label and the U label. It's also for the, as I mentioned, the registrar information information, we are recommending that it stay in US ASCII format so that a lot of people, it's sort of like existing work, so you can contact the registrar. And then for the EPP status code, that for the registration status, that needs to be in the EPP status code format. So basically, it boils down to I mentioned about the four models in terms of the Whois information internationalized registration data for contact and contact name and contact address. We need input from the community on which direction to take. And then also on the preliminary recommendations, whether people think they make sense, and whether we missed out some things that needs to be internationalized and we haven't considered. So, I think that's the end of the presentation.
Yeah. Thanks, Edmund. Tim, you have a question? And.
Edmund, has any thought been given to where this data resides in, or are you implying that it resides with the registrars, thinking in context of a thick registry, or do both the registrar and the registry maintain that data? So if it is given, say, in Model 4 and both and the registrar translates, does all that data go to the registry? Is there any assumption too as to who is the authoritative in that thick registry model? Who's authoritative? Is it still the registry?
I think it was the discussion. The intention was that it was sort of it doesn't really matter whether it's a thin registry or thick registry. the Northic Registry. And right now, at least the intention is for the registrar who has the relationship with the contact, regardless of whether it's a thin registry or thick registry, it's the registrar that has the relationship with the registrant and the contact to provide the information. Whether it's Model 3 or 4, where some transliteration or translation would take place.
Okay, so my question was, is that the translated data, for example, or the transliterated data, is that getting passed to the registry in a thick model then?
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Mike?
forgive me if I missed this. So the initial report is done. Is it out for public comment now? Or what's the next steps for the council, if any?
It is out for public comments. It was originally going to close in mid-January, but because it's about internationalized data, we did a translation of the report into different various languages, and I think now it's, Julie, it's...
Yeah, it's March 14th. We had it translated into, it was originally in English, and we translated it into the other five UN languages and extended the time period for comment to ensure that those languages had the same amount of time to view the document. But the work group will continue to meet and consider other questions that they have not yet addressed and also any comments coming out of that period while it's open.
So to answer your question, there's really no council action at this time, just an update and trying to get more people to participate and give us the feedback through the comment period.
Can I just ask, Edmund, did you think during your work on the actual format of the WHOIS, did anyone ever suggest that you have a language tag? Because it may not be obvious to some what the language is. Do you understand what I mean?
That's a good point. I think the language tag issue did come up at one point. I think we sort of missed it at the, when we... But the language tag on the domain name, that
yeah.
was... But then you're talking about language tag on the contact information as well.
No, I'm talking about... I mean, I presume that the contact information would be the same in the same language as the domain name if it's shown in a, that may not be a fair assumption, actually, in which case you'd need some on both.
But that's a pretty good input. I think we probably missed that. It's a good thing. We should look into that.
Yeah. Adrian was next, actually, and then Philip, and then Jeff.
And Stefan will probably jump in any time in between those guys. Just be prepared.
Actually, sorry, I got that cue wrong. It was Philip next.
Keep it up, laughing boy. Edmund, I'm just going to go out on a limb here. I don't get a lot of what you're talking about. I just feel like there is a fear that we're going to get thrown something. And it's just either A, it will require a lot of my bandwidth to get up to speed. And I hope I'm speaking for some others here. Otherwise, you know, I really am as stupid as I think. Avery's confirmed that. So either way, it's going to take a lot of bandwidth, or I'm going to end up voting on something I know nothing about. And I know that's not necessarily your fault, but this sounds like it's very, very technical. But at the same time, as Avery's just been helping me out, it's a policy thing. It's not an IETF thing. It's a policy decision around something that is incredibly technical. And at that, I'm struggling to keep up with this. So... maybe the end question is there a fear here or do you even care that this will come across with the next steps, whether we vote on the recommendations, that you believe that councils will be voting on something that they don't know? Or I mean, am I alone here? Maybe that's a better way to ask a question. If so, you don't even need to answer it. Are there any other councillors here that are very comfortable with the?
So I don't understand what you mean. I'm sorry, this is Mike Rudenbaugh. I don't understand what you mean by the super complicated technical issues here, Adrian. And I'm certainly can barely spell DNS, but I don't really I don't see the issues.
I like that. I'm using that. More around the recommendations themselves with respect to how they impact the character sets within the variants.
This on a report that you've obviously read, Adrian.
I beg your pardon?
You've obviously read the report, so you understand what...
No, I haven't read the report, Stefan.
Okay?
Well, I'll see you outside and Greco-Roman you to the ground. So maybe that's what I'm saying. I admitted that it will take a lot of bandwidth for me to get up to speed. Now, I can't read every report on it, every topic. That's why there's three councillors here, and I'll take their advice on some. I'm talking about from the stakeholder group.
No,
if the short answer is you just want me to shut up and read it all and get up to speed, then that's it. I'll take that on board. But
No. I think I should take part of the blame. I probably presented it not very in a very friendly way. There are certain parts of which is a little bit more technical, like the variance issues. But there are certain parts where clearly it's fairly simple in terms of the four models, like what should registrars require registrants to what information you should collect.
Yes.
It's not so much that I'm having trouble with
as I said.
So I think our job probably is to try to for the parts where it's a little bit more technical, try to crystallize it a little bit better for the council as we move forward. But I think overall there are a few major policy decisions that need to be made, and at this point, because it's still a sort of an interim report, we branched out a few things, so that sort of made it more complicated. Once we come up, we end up with a final set of recommendations, it might be better crystallized for you.
Okay. I have, Philip, Jeff, and Tim.
Thank you. It's Philip Shepherd. In the report, have you gone down those options yet and done analysis in terms of strengths and weaknesses of some of them?
Well, actually, there are in the report there is some of the discussion, the actual discussion that took place, like Model 1, Model 2, and Model 3, and Model 4, of what, the participants thought. So, for example, Model 3 and Model 4 requires the registrar to do some extra work. Is that going to cost more? So yes, in the report it actually says that. I haven't put out the details, but there are some. But
so. And in that analysis, I mean, I was curious to see the suggestion that some of it could be there could be translations and transliterations done at the registrar level, because I mean, both those things are more arts than science, and there's often options in terms of the way you do them. And without determining in advance a one method and standardized method, if that exists for all the various scripts to do it, you will end up with variations of translations and transliterations based on the same script, which just strikes me as being not a good way to go. Was that discussed?
I think that was discussed to a certain extent, and that's exactly why it's left to the registrar, which has the contact with the registrant and also have the local context within which transliterations or translations are being done. And that's sort of the idea, and I don't quite get what, let's say they're registrar A, registrar B, they live in, let's say, China, different parts of China. They might have, let's say in Hong Kong versus in mainland China versus in Taiwan, then they probably, we do have different transliteration sort of conventions. And so the registrar would have different ways of presenting it, and I don't think that would be a issue. I don't know whether Julie or Steve wants to add to that.
At the beginning, the issue about translation is the cost. I think. Oh, this is Steve Cheng, one of the staff supporting the working group. The issue with translation is the cost implications to registrars, and that's been signaled as a major barrier. There were some suggestions about automated translations being done. Actually, if you if you're using Google's translation service, they've done a pretty good job. But to what extent that technologies can be leveraged in registration systems, that question is unknown. Thank you.
One more thing, just quickly, is we also considered whether the information ultimately is usable in a way that, let's say, the postal address, when it's transliterated, I don't think we expect that you can actually write an envelope and send it. But it does allow certain mechanism, like, for lack of a better word, harvesting, to figure out some data about certain registrations. And for example, I understand that even IPR lawyers or law enforcement sometimes take a look at the WHOIS and do pattern matching. That would help, you know, certain tools if certain transliteration is done.
Thanks, Jeff.
Actually, that's a really good segue to the question I have. In the new version of the applicant guidebook, in the last version, it said that each registry had to have a searchable WHOIS and pretty much defined everything as searchable. They removed that, sort of, but said that they're setting up a board committee, not GNSO, but board committee that's going to look at this, and the board committee could reintroduce it. Putting aside the very large policy problem of having a board committee that determines top-down the policy, if there's a requirement that's put back in to make everything searchable, is that even going to be possible under this? And if all of these have to be searchable, whether it's the A or the U, the tremendous requirements on a registry would just be incredible. So, and I doubt the group's considered it, but I think it's something that the group may want to flag to the board of directors before they unilaterally make a decision as to what should be searchable and not for new GTLDs.
We're actually out of time, so can I, sorry. I mean, Mike, I know you've got your hand up, but Tim was next, and we're over time as it is. So can I just go to Tim and then cut this short? Okay. Well, in that case, Mike, do you want the last?
Just like just to explain a little bit further why it is such a burden on a registry to make a few extra fields searchable. I don't get it.
Take a look at the SLAs. Take a look at the language they've added, and we could talk about it offline, but... There's much larger. The more data you have, the more searchability you have, the more burden it's on the registry systems and registrar systems.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks, Edmund. Alan, and Michele. And we'll go straight into the next session, which will be chaired by.